Coffee Sketch Podcast is our take on the intersection of old tech and new tech, the space between the traditional practice of the hand-drawn sketch that has been performed by architects and designers for centuries, and the modern-day use of the hashtag as a representation of a sentiment or a movement. Each week we plan to deliver a new pod about our ideas, sketches, and what's going on in our daily lives as we pursue our love of architecture, design, and sharing this knowledge with the next generation. I'm Kurt, and I'm in Flint.
And I'm Jamie, and I'm in Austin.
Hey, Jamie. How you doing?
Good. How are you, Kurt?
Not too bad. I got a little allergies. These sniffles are no COVID relations to my sniffle.
That's good. Yeah.
And not to make light of it, but it seems like nowadays, you know, it's justifiable to make sure that any kind of respiratory congestion or something is put, you know, put through the stress test of pandemic relations. But
are you yeah. Fully caffeinated though for today?
Oh, well, you know, I've already I'm fully fired up. My wife is working with her sister at the farmer's market. I think I've mentioned this, at the cheese shop at the farmer's market. And right next to them is, I don't know if I ever told you about this. So there's a little coffee stand right next to the cheese stand. So the woman that owns the coffee stand is, her name's Rebecca. It's also my sister-in-law's name, so it's easy to remember. But her coffee shop is called Penny's Cafe, named after her chicken. But the coffee the vendor Rebecca is a huge Twin Peaks fan, and somehow and she lived in California. They used to live in LA area, so somehow when she's fairly new. It's kind of funny. Well, not funny, but she actually opened up right before the pandemic and then had to shut down. And then, you know, the whole farmer's market was kind of like in a lockdown, curbside only for quite a while. And then only recently they reopened, you know, with some social distancing measures and masks and stuff like that. So she, the coffee shop, owner, actually had to, had quite a non-start of a new business, right?
Right.
And so, luckily, it's kind of like a second career for her. She's, raised some children, and so she's, you know, kind of getting into the coffee thing because as a fan and, you know, as a Twin Peaks fan, it's no surprise, right?
Right. Now that you're a Twin Peaks, you know, aficionado as well, and your love of coffee is clear by this podcast.
That's right.
Now you're seeing all the linkages starting to come together
in
out in the wild even.
It's right. A damn fine cup of coffee, right? So
yeah.
So she knows. So now I know we've had fun little chats talking about moments in Twin Peaks and all the innuendo of coffee and things behind the scenes and stuff like that. So she even has like the books and the diary and all the other, what do you call it? Supplemental, components to the show. So super fan.
Yeah. Just like Jason and I. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've gotten into a habit of dropping off Danielle and then picking up some nice hot black coffee, as black as a moonless night.
Exactly. And
So anyway, yeah, I'm amped, ready to go. How about you? Are you sipping on anything? I mean, I also said before we pushed record that it dipped into the 30s last night here in Michigan, which is it makes coffee drinking even a higher priority on my list.
Right. Yeah.
Not so much.
Yeah. The coffee intake definitely does increase when the temperature does change. So no, I'm still trying to fool myself that it's fall. So I'm still having some of that maple pecan blend that I found. And that's it's doing the work a little bit, but you know, when it's 85 degrees outside, you're really playing tricks on your head. So
yeah. And not to digress too much, but when I lived in the Southern California days, every day being around 70 degrees, the only thing that marks fall is like when football season starts, which right now, and by football, I mean American football. So I don't, confuse not our audience.
Not the football that I'm, you know, going to be watching later today.
That's right. So, yeah, I can see the one aspect of moving to Michigan is the fall is actually fall. Although we're, you know, technically we have a couple days until we're officially in fall, but at the equinox, but it already feels like it. So I'm glad you're getting into the spirit, even though you don't have the temps. I honestly would like it to stay warm. one nice thing while it's, you know, been going through the pandemic life is the, you know, the warmer temps and being able to be outside as long as the day is. The colder, although right now it's nice, it's 60s, but you know, for us Michiganders, we can tolerate into the 60s during the day with sun. So I'm not complaining. But I'll try and temper my caffeine buzz and maybe roll right into the first couple of sketches here, because we picked out these. I think because the subject is Eric Owen Moss, recently was the recipient of AIA National's 25-year award, but not for one building, but actually for a cluster of buildings or a whole urban enclave, is what I'm going to call it, or a master plan, I suppose, is the formal term. But it's an interesting collection of buildings in Culver City, California, that I believe the formal name, I guess, of the project is Conjunctive Points. But it you know, so it's in the Culver City neighborhood, part of Los Angeles, and so if anyone is aware of Eric Owen Moss's work, you know, it has not been there. There's like, you know, we'll get into this in a second, but you know, if you've seen one of these buildings, there are within walking distance quite a handful more. And it's really interesting for them to choose this as a 25-year award. And what Jamie has done has created a couple of sketches of some of the most notable, one older and one newer building within this district that are really great and kind of a fun throwback for me, at least to the first sketch, because it goes back to my days as a student in Los Angeles and visiting this, you know, for the first time as a student and seeing it in reality. And I think the first building, which is nicknamed the Stealth Building, was recently completed when I was a student. And I'm not going to talk about the years, the years I was there. But so Jamie, what... Tell me why you chose the Stealth, and then we'll go to the new building, or unless you want to talk about both back and forth. But thanks for creating these sketches once the award was announced this past week or so.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that, I mean, the stealth was one that, you know, it's not having, you know, gone to school in that part of the country. You know, it was, you would see these, you know, through the magazines or, mm-hmm. you know, through lectures or and I think that, you know, they, I think they were, you know, referred to some of this as the Santa Monica School, you know, kind of idea. You know, some people have referred to it that way with, you know, Frank Lloyd, not Frank Lloyd Wright.
the other Frank.
The other Frank. Frank
Gehry.
Yeah, Fogg.
Frank Gehry.
yeah. The Canadian, the Canuck.
That's right.
So, you know, the, I think, you know, and there's certainly a lot of others, you know, that, you know, contributed, and then a lot of the schools and the students, you know, that kind of were in that area and sort of seeing some of these developments. But I think the thing that stood out to me with the Erico and Moss project was that, you know, as I learned a little bit more, you know, we've talked about it here on the podcast before, is that, you know, some of what you do in architecture school, and then just in practice as well, that always sort of fascinated me was learning about the process. As you know, I would see these images of buildings, and then want, you know, add them to the list of places that I wanted to go visit. And I have been to see stealth. But the you know, you also sort of are fascinated by the process of, you know, where do these ideas come from? And, you know, not just, you know, from the architecture team, but where are the influences to that team? And then also in this particular case, what I found fascinating was there was a lot of writing at the time about the developer who, you know, had this large swath of land and really, you know, kind of talked about, you know, patronage. It talks about, you know, the, you know, that and not patronage like, in a bad way. I mean, I think that, you know, sometimes, you know, patrons are sort of, there's a, at least in kind of culture, you know, sometimes, you know, patrons are kind of viewed in a little bit of a, like there's some pandering, you know, by an artist or an architect, you know, and I don't think that I'm not referring to it that way. I'm talking about it more of that there's this relationship between, owner and artist that to me sort of harkens back to, you know, Western architectural history, where you're looking at someone like, you know, Michelangelo, or, you know, an artist, you know, from the Renaissance, or, you know, or, another period where they have literal patrons who are aiding these starving artists by giving them work, giving them commissions, you know, encouraging them with, you know, certain projects. And I think that this seems to be one of those kind of modern cases that really took it to quite an extreme. And I like the fact that, you know, this particular project becomes a 25-year award, because there's it's master planned, but then there's, you know, quite a number of individual buildings that are sort of built over time. And I don't know the story of all of them as well as I maybe would like, but I mean, there's the Beehive project, and there's some other warehouse projects, and Stealth was one that always sort of stood out to me. But, you know, from what I understand, that there was a lot of underutilized industrial buildings in this part of Culver City. And so if people are trying to figure out where Culver City is, you know, think about, you know, and you could probably give a better geography lesson to it, but, you know, this is where a lot of movie studios exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like the space between downtown and Santa Monica, which is the beach.
Right.
It's closer to Santa Monica than it is downtown, but it's kind of like this, in between space where, Yeah, there was a lot of warehouses for the film industry. I think a lot of it was, you know, back when they used film,
right?
Just like our podcast is being recorded on digital format, not actual tapes. But they stored a lot of the canisters of film from all the, you know, all the recordings in warehouse space. And I think part of this complex was, you know, this industrial, it's not in LA terms, this sort of industrial is not like your factory or your sort of gritty, like here in the Midwest, industrial space. It's just kind of like large warehouse buildings for storage. So it's not as like gritty feeling, or you just don't have as many sort of people per square mile, just because the buildings are so large. So this is, it is like this no man's land, very close to a lot of other things, though. You know, Culver City downtown has the old Main Street area, or you could call it a Main Street, but it's Venice Boulevard, and then, oh shoot, now I can't remember the offshoot, but basically, you know, the main drag through Culver City has a lot of more historic buildings that were the iconic visual parts of Culver City. And then back behind, you know, the blocks behind kind of were these warehouses. I would imagine it's probably just a proximity thing, like being able to service the Hollywood industry on the west side of the city. But yeah, so Moss, like you said, and I think you put it, you know, I would say hit the nail on the head with the relationship aspect. The way I understood it as a student was the client and Errico and Moss, like, you know, cultivated this relationship over, well, now decades, from an early, I mean, it would be probably early on from Errico and Moss's career,
right?
As a practicing architect and, you know,
and educator.
Creating, I mean, religion. Right.
You know, and I think that's the thing, is that, you know, what sort of fascinated me, and the reason why I bring it up that way, is that, you know, you read in history books about the Medicis, or, you know, these different people who were patrons for, you know, artists of note that we go and look at their work in museums now. And, you know, and you say, well, how did this happen? How did these, you know, amazing talents, you know, that were from, you know, like Leonardo da Vinci is from Vinci. I mean, you know, it's a very, very small town. And right, so, like, how is someone like that, I mean, arguably a genius, you know, and a talent, but I mean, how is somebody like that now one of the most famous, you know, artistic names that you can think of? You know, with, you know, paintings in the Louvre and all these things, it's, you know, the Mona Lisa, you know, whatever and a lot of it has to do with these patrons who were paying for the work. You know, and that whole process is just sort of fascinating to me. You know, because even, you know, with other artists, like, you know, in New York, you have Basquiat and, Warhol, you know, teaming up and, you know, Warhol's factory, and, it's you see that sort of patronage of the arts that allows for these works to come to fruition. And you know, of architects that I studied, you know, this story about Moss really, really, you know, seemed to be at a level that, you know, I'm sure exists with many other architects, but it's one that I think was, also indicative of his career, like you were about to say, I think, before I totally interrupted you.
Oh, no. Oh, that's fine. No, and we can fold in the second sketch, because the fun part is the this is a newer building, again, in the same district or, you know, master plan, but this is actually, I believe this one is a ground up building, where a lot of the earlier ones were, and I'll get to more detail in a second, additions or alterations to existing buildings, and or interventions is probably a better word. And this one is the Vespertine, and it's kind of like this undulating tower, three or four floors, which for me, it's really one of my favorite concepts, is a small footprint, but a stacked set of plates. So a mini tower, so to speak. I mean, obviously, it's only four floors or so. So, but there's always something I was always a fan of as a student, was like the interaction between levels in the vertical plane, you know, going up up from the ground, you know, in the Z axis, as we would say. Yeah, in architecture.
Thinking in section.
Yeah. And so the Vespertine is a newer one. And I believe it's only a couple, two, three, well, could be a little bit more than that, years old. It houses, its primary purpose is a restaurant, I believe, for a, kind of like one of those premier celebrity chefs from Los Angeles. I forget the guy's name too, but I think he's been on TV and stuff like that. But the idea of the client again, and the educational aspect is, you know, I believe a lot of these, the early ones, like you mentioned, the beehive, and there was this weird, like, kind of eyeball. I always refer to it like an eyeball, because it's totally an intervention on the facade of the building, where it's just like this sort of bump that he built, like this round sphere that's like just popping out of the building. And that's about all you see, right? And then inside, maybe they did some internal walls and, you know, office space layout. But Stealth is kind of like a front bar building. And then this is the moment in time when, so we, luckily as students, you know, we took a tour with the faculty at USC and took us out there. And, you know, we walked the area. At that time, there weren't as many of them as there are now. But Stealth was there. I think the one they call Samatar, which is next to Stealth. It's very similar, kind of a long rectangular building. And I think actually Eric Owen Moss's office is near all this too, in a neighboring, you know, converted warehouse or something like that.
That's correct.
But and then there's there was the one called the I think they call it the Umbrella, where it has this sort of, it is an experiment in like slumping glass or creating three-dimensionally formed glass, and created this canopy that is, it's like, I believe the building is primarily office space, and this glass canopy is kind of like a feature on the corner, like a conference room in the corner that has this sort of glass canopy that's like a patio almost. So it's a very interesting, you know, going through a career, you know, now I'm in, you know, almost 20 years into a career. There's a point when you start hitting that, you know, you go from school into practice and you start realizing like how much buildings cost. And then you go, you know, that umbrella building, like, you know, dollars per square foot seem like a whole lot of money spent on like something that doesn't really even occupy, like create occupiable space. And then you come back, right? You have to circle back and go, but it's not about the cost of the building, because a lot of these, like I said, are additions or interventions on an existing warehouse, which if you looked at, you know, for warehouses, a warehouse is a big rectangular box, and a lot of these in the west side were what we call like a bowstring truss roof. So in California, they built a lot of, you have a concrete block wall, and then they have these nice arching, curving roof trussed buildings, right? So these nice wooden trusses, and you know, for like the artists out there, or people that are super into like loft art, artists loft like spaces, you know, these became ultra popular all over LA to convert into apartments, because they were big open spaces with a lot of beautiful rustic looking materials. And so anyway, well, the
and because you could configure all the spaces underneath it because the structure was the long
free span.
Yeah, it was the free span.
Exactly. But then looking at it one way, and I don't know if you've ever, when you actually walk through there, you're in your own experience, it sometimes felt weird that like there was this funky, I'm going to say funky, but you know, the stealth, you know, is this a very abstract building in the front and then the warehouse behind. And so you had these sort of the architecture word juxtaposition between this very artistic intervention and then the very utilitarian warehouse. And a lot of them had these fronts, these almost, and it's very LA, I suppose, if you, and I don't know what Eric would think about this, but if, you know, like Hollywood, right, you would have the, like Universal Studios would have just facades of the downtown, you know, and then behind it was nothing, right? It was, it's all about this, the skin, the surface. And it kind of has, you could, I mean, you know, one could read it that way where it's this, what's the word I'm thinking of? Commentary on the architecture of Los Angeles or the Hollywoodness of Los Angeles in building form. But then, you know, I think the 25-year award, though, speaks to the overall aggregate, the combination of all these buildings together, like, and then moving into the one like Vespertine, where it is its own thing and kind of has, you know, four sides, not just one or two sides, you know, four sides of an elevation to kind of explore architectural form and things like that. So,
well, and it's you know, it's the thing too, that, you know, like you're saying is, you know, we've been doing this for a little while now, you know, in our careers. And I think that, you know, a lot of these influences, I still think ring true, and are still really, really interesting and important. But at the same time, even though some of those ideas about cost and purpose and process were really, really evident, you know, early on in trying to understand, you know, how things mm-hmm. worked, mm-hmm. You know, it was, I think it was something that, you know, for me, you know, when I saw that the award had been given, it resonated from the standpoint that all of this is, you know, like you say, a bit of a commitment, you know, but a commitment both by patron and architect's team, you know, over a long period of time to, you know, have these interventions in projects to begin with, and then move from intervention to, and that's why I like, you know, that we're talking about both sketches is, you know, this very, very current project, you know, that is, you know, a literally, you know, ground up new construction but still embodies, I think, a lot of the experimentation of the earlier works. But it's almost like that this experimental lab, you know, ends up creating, you know, projects like this. And I think that there's, you know, an individual like Eric Owen Moss, you know, who, you know, balances between practice and the academy. You know, he's been, I think, dean of SciArc, you know, I don't believe he is now, but, you know, and I'm sure faculty at other schools in LA and other and around the country. But I think that sort of full narrative for this work is really applicable and really kind of interesting. And I think it's an interest, like you said, it was sort of surprising to see it kind of gifted or honored this way, I guess. But at the same time, you kind of you like it. I mean, I think that there's something to be said for the commitment on the architecture team's part to all of these interventions, and then how they, you're almost creating your own context, but at the same time respecting a context to a certain degree too, and then, you know, developing rules about that space. And I mean, the concept of rehabilitating a building is really fascinating to me regardless. I mean, it can be sometimes the greenest thing to do is take an existing mm-hmm. structure and give it new life. You know, I don't want to, you know, overspeak, you know, that some of these interventions are very, very costly, and are more of an artistic vein than a functional one. But sometimes that's really important as well to the architecture. And I don't think that goes unnoticed with an honoree like this, but it's, it was a place that I had on my, you know, sort of architecture pilgrimage site where you have to, you know, you have mm-hmm. to go see some of these things to believe it and to understand it. And, mm-hmm. and that facadism that you're talking about, I think is evident in some of the work, but at the same time, it does sort of blur the line of, you know, it's not just a false front. There's a little bit more kind of going on, and mm-hmm. and some of it's more surgical, like you were talking about with mm-hmm. You know, the umbrella project and whatnot. There's some other kind of interesting ways that spaces are treated and handled. But that experimentation it's sort of architecture research as well, and I think it's but at the same time functional to a certain degree and fascinating. I think that, you know, that fascination really is important, and in a place like LA and Culver City, I think it's, you know, it's appropriate.
The other aspect that always was fun as a student, and it's still fun, but they often did get names, like nicknames, or each project, right?
Don't you name your projects? Come on. Doesn't everybody?
Well, I've not yet named, I mean, I don't think I could now, but I'd not ever had one named Pterodactyl, as he has, Eric Onmas has. The one project when I was a student, which was only in design concept, but did eventually get built. I don't know how, it's probably not that long ago. But back behind the stealth building, there was a parking deck, and the one he named Pterodactyl was like some office space that kind of, it's like landed on top of the parking deck, but then like deformed the ramps of the, you know, so it kind of looks like it, you know, smashed right into the parking deck, like as if a pterodactyl landed or something like that. And it did get built. And that's the fun part of this. I think one of the best parts about the whole group of these buildings is that it didn't stop in development. It's continuing to grow and evolve. And every few years, you know, a new building or a new project is added to the group. So it's one of, like you said, having, you know, the patron client that is continuing the legacy of the whole, of the intent of the master plan, I should say, like the original concept of we're eventually, you know, it is strange because it seems very rare to have conceptualized a lot of these buildings 20 plus to 25 years ago, right? So the pterodactyl was a concept, you know, 20 years ago, and then now it's actually built, but it's not really any different than the concept design. It actually does exist as it was conceptualized, even though it took maybe 10 to 15 years to come to life. And I think that is the strength of the concept and the I don't know if some people may say it's the sort of the force of Eric Onmas not wanting to compromise anything from an early vision. I don't want to sound negative, but if the concept is the concept, you know, it's being carried out in the way it was originally conceived. Think about any... Like Da Vinci or Michelangelo, or you know, the Renaissance artists who, you know, maybe, you know, designed things that, you know, took, or even like Sagrada Familia, for example, maybe as a building that, you know, is trying to get finished as it was designed originally, or, you know, long after the initial, you know, designer, architect, you know, person is dead. So anyway, I don't know where I was going with
that. Well, no, I mean, I think
it's, you know, not to get too,
well, it, you know, we are talking about some sketches that, you know, clearly inspired me. And I think that, you know, like you say, it's there, you know, in one case, it's one that I, you know, visited and made a real point to go visit. And then the other, I'm only getting to see in images. And, you know, I even put in the hashtag, you know, it's, you know, when we can dine again. And so I think that's sort of where some of this, you know, lies, is that, you know, these places are intended, you know, architecture is intended to inspire. I mean, it's also intended to, you know, serve a greater good. And, you know, it doesn't always do that. But I think that, in the influence of many, many students of architecture, you know, the work of Aaron Cohen Moss and others, Zaha Hadid, you know, I think when it started out as paper architecture, and then through the power and strength of those individuals to realize their visions, you know, even if technology didn't always, you know, had to play catch up to it to some degree, I think that there's an amazing influence in that. And I've been thinking about those things a lot, you know, as I'm working in historic structures and, you know, what modern buildings of today or the past 25, 30 years are we going to be honoring and, you know, adding to and, you know, noting the influence of. And I think that something like this kind of caught my eye, you know, for a lot of those, you know, more reasons and questions in those reasons, which I think is, you know, and I'm glad you and I were able to talk about it.
Thanks for bringing me back. But I was just thinking about, as probably my final thought was that, you know, I was really hoping to go, you know, to the AIA conference this year, because it was going to be in LA, and we've talked about this before. Because for the same reason that we were, and I believe we purchased the tickets to this tour, we were going to go see.
Yeah, we did.
The Moss, the conjunctive point space. And because I haven't been back in a while, and Vespertine was not built at, you know, when I left LA, and I was really looking forward to seeing this space plus some other buildings that are now on the map of this way. So unfortunately, we'll have to wait. Either we find an excuse to get to LA before the AIA conference comes back, or we'll wait to the next LA turn for AIA conference. I hope it's sooner than later, and we can check these spaces out. You know, one other thing is the because you made a point about the technology aspect, and, you know, like Stealth was built, I'm pretty sure he may have had some 3D software but I'm pretty sure they did most of that with hand drawings and, or at least two-dimensional CAD, but not, you know, not BIM or Rhino or Grasshopper, you know, or any generative modeling software. And, you know, when we were students, you know, some people would get kind of infatuated with like platonic shapes, you know, circles, square, triangle, you know, things that have these, you know, well, that, you know, that platonic sort of, you know, notion of known quantity, right? So then the Stealth building is like a square on one end and a triangle on the other, and it morphs between a three-sided and a four-sided object. And if, you know, if a sound effect that I'm making, you know, like the, my brain, you know, all our brains exploded, you know, when we sat through the lecture, and either the instructor or we were at a lecture where Moss was talking about his buildings, because, you know, he was in the LA area. So we, you know, he was often lecturing around town, and you're just like, but how, how did he do it? And, you know, it's still one of those things as a finished building 25 years later that has the same weight of that ability to transform the shape of, you know, the form of the building. So, you know, that's I could go on and on with this stuff because it's been so fun to see it grow and evolve over time. So, but I'll stop.
Thank you for listening. We both hope that you enjoyed this episode of Coffee Sketch Podcast. Our theme music is provided by my brother, who goes by at Cold Fashion on Instagram and Twitter. Our podcast is hosted at coffeesketch.buzzsprout.com. Find more show notes and information from this episode. And finally, if you like what you heard, please rate us on iTunes and share us with your friends. Thank you.